Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Well, this is the time of the summer blockbuster film, which usually involves alien or zombie invasion or asteroids threatening Earth or some form of annihilation that threatens the very existence of life on Earth. That's all good fun, right? Well, today we speak with someone who actually considers the reality of a mass extinction. Earth history tells us it's already happened 5 times. Annalee Newitz is a science writer who investigated the mass extinctions of the past and spoke with researchers and futurists who worry about our survival in the future, from biologists and epidemiologists to city planners and space scientists, for her book, Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. It's published by Doubleday, and believe it or not, it's an optimistic book. And the book is a fascinating primer on the Earth's geologic, biologic, and anthropologic history, along with a look at futuristic technologies and ideas that just might save us when the big one comes, whatever that may be. Annalee Newitz is the founding editor of the science website io9.com and a journalist who's written for Wired, Popular Science, and The Washington Post. She's also the editor of the anthology She's Such a Geek, Women Write About Science, Technology, and Other Geeky Stuff, and was a Knight Science Journalism Fellow at MIT. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Annalee Newitz, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
In your book, you write there have been 5 mass extinctions in the past 450 million years of the Earth's history. And even today, scientists are speculating on when, not if, the next big mass extinction will occur and whether it may already be underway. I'm interested, what interests you in this big subject?
Well, it actually all started with disaster movies. I'm a huge fan of fictional disaster movies, and I wanted to, in my book, find out what the worst possible real-life disaster might be and write about that. And mass extinctions are really the worst disaster that can ever happen. They're events where 75% or more species on the planet die out, which is obviously a horrific amount of death. And it happens in a relatively short period of time geologically, which is a million years. So that's very fast from the perspective of the planet, which is 4.5 billion years old, but from the perspective of the creatures who are living through this disaster, it's really a kind of, it's interesting because it's a slow motion disaster, and it's very hard to perceive in one lifetime unless you can use historical documents and use science to figure out what's happening before it's too late. And that's kind of what we're doing right now.
Now, that's an interesting theory, I think, to most people who think of when these mass extinction events, if they know about them, as happening, you know, asteroid strike, boom, a couple of years, everything's dead. You're talking about a much longer timeline for these mass extinctions. Is that a misnomer?
It's really true that when you have a mass extinction, which is, you know, a tremendous magnitude in terms of how many creatures are dying out, it takes a while, and oftentimes they're set off by terrible disasters. So most people have heard about how 65 million years ago, an asteroid smashed into the Earth and killed off most of the dinosaurs. But that actually wasn't a sudden or instantaneous event. There would have been incredible die-offs in the region of that asteroid strike, of course, and there would have been fires, and it would have been very uncomfortable on the planet for quite a while. But what causes something like a mass extinction always takes a lot longer. And what that asteroid actually did 65 million years ago was set off a period of climate change, really rapid shifts in the climate from very cold right after the asteroid strike to warming up into what today we would call an extreme greenhouse. And those kinds of dramatic fluctuations in climate are what kill animals and plants off over time, because it changes habitats, it changes the kinds of food that are available, and oftentimes animals die of starvation rather than something more exciting and Hollywood blockbuster like a huge explosion. So there's a kind of initial horrific disaster and then a slow starvation of many other species over that million years.
So the megafauna that managed to survive the initial event, probably that die-off doesn't begin with them. It begins with their food sources, whether it's plants or small animals that they live on, right? And it kind of moves up the food
chain? Absolutely. It generally does. And that's one of the reasons why today people worry a lot about things that seem kind of strange. Like, why do we worry about coral reefs dying off? It's not just because we think there are beautiful places to go diving, although that's true. It's because if a coral reef dies off, that's kind of at the bottom of the food chain for a lot of animals in the ocean. And so even if changes to the ocean aren't directly killing fish and aren't directly killing plants, if a coral reef dies out, then that will kill off a lot of the animals that live on the coral reef and that live off of the animals that live on the coral reef and off of the plants that live there. So it's the same idea where you see the bottom of the food chain knocked out, and then it creates what are called knock-on extinctions, knock-on events where more animals die because animals are dying. Yeah. So there's this magnification. And about 50 years ago, humans figured out that the planet goes through periodic climate changes, regardless of whether humans are affecting it or not, and that these climate changes are often correlated with mass extinctions because of those temperature fluctuations and habitat changes. And so the fact that humans figured that out just 50 years ago, and in a time since then, the issue of climate change has become an incredibly important part of the international political agenda, I think is actually a sign that humans really can figure out these problems and start to do something about them. Now, obviously, it would be great if we could solve everything tomorrow and everyone could agree on what the problem really was, and you know, that's something that we're going to have to work out. But when you think about the slow-motion disaster of mass extinction taking place over a million years, the fact that we in only 50 years have started to tackle the problem is kind of amazing. It makes us a pretty adaptable and smart species compared to some of the other species that have had to deal with this stuff before.
My guest today is Annalee Newitz, a founding editor of the science website io9.com and the author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. It's published by Doubleday, and it tells our geologic history, our biologic history, and talks about a lot of these major mass extinctions that occurred over the past 450 to 500 million years ago across Earth history. And then you take us into the present of, you know, there are people thinking about these problems and thinking about possible solutions. It's a really, really interesting book, and she joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Well, before we talk about today, let's talk about the five major events, because I was aware of two of them. I think the asteroid strike that ended the dinosaurs, the Permian strike, which I think was volcanic activity and maybe an asteroid as well somewhere in Russia. It seems like I remember that.
Mm-hmm. There was a super volcano in Russia, and then there may also have been a meteor strike as well. We just don't know.
Tell us about the other three, and that would be the Permian extinction and, of course, the dinosaurs of the Cretaceous-Tertiary extinction. What were the other three mass extinctions, and what happened? Do we know what caused them?
What we do know is that each of these events, or most of these events, were correlated with climate changes. And we don't always know what caused those climate changes, but when we look back in the geological record and we look at layers of rock from millions of years ago, we see changes in the rocks and also changes in the fossils that indicate, for example, about 450 million years ago, during the first mass extinction, we know there was a very rapid ice age. And there's a lot of theories about how that happened, including the theory that there was a nearby supernova that bombarded the planet with high-energy particles, gamma rays, and that may have changed our atmosphere and filled it with clouds that blocked the light and caused sudden appearances of sheets of ice everywhere on the planet, which would, of course, been devastating for the life forms that lived in the water. And then there was another mass extinction that followed about 350 million years ago. So, you know, 100 million years later, life has kind of rejuvenated itself. And this mass extinction, this was at the end of the Devonian period, so it's called the End-Devonian mass extinction. And that one is an interesting one because it may have been caused by invasive species, which is something we worry about a lot today. And there's evidence that there were climate changes going on. There was a lot of volcanic activity in the Atlantic. But at the same time, what we see in the fossil record is not so much that species were dying out, but that no new species were evolving to replace the species that died out at a normal rate. And what that suggests to some paleozoologists is that we may actually have been seeing species that just moved into new territories, took up all the space and all the food, and forced all of this local species to die out because they just couldn't compete. And so that might be our first example of a mass extinction being caused basically by overpopulation on the part of certain very successful species, including sharks, by the way, or the ancestors of sharks. So yeah. You can blame sharks for one of the mass extinctions.
Yeah, I could see that on the animal side because migration, you know, that's a lot of animals do it. And you also have probably at that point really evolving landforms. I'm not sure. My geologic history is a little hazy. But what about plants? Because when we think of invasive plant species, we think of man having a large hand in that, you know, by transporting and trade.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the earliest extinction events on the planet was actually caused by blue-green algae, which are also known as cyanobacteria. So they're kind of they look a little bit like plant-like because when you see them floating on the water, they look like scum, but they're actually bacteria. And this was very early in the Earth's history when these guys evolved. And their big evolutionary advantage was they evolved photosynthesis, which is how plants get energy from sunlight. So they were kind of the earliest plants in that sense, or they ultimately evolved into certain plants. And so what they did was, because they were photosynthesizing, they were releasing a lot of oxygen into the environment. And about this time, say 2 billion years ago or so, the planet's atmosphere was mostly methane, and so most of the life forms on the planet, which were generally single-celled life forms, a few multicellular life forms, they were methane breathers. That was their favorite environment. And when all of these cyanobacteria started pumping oxygen into the environment, it actually polluted the environment for all these other life forms. And so we might not call this a mass extinction because it took place over billions of years instead of a million years, but it did completely pollute the entire atmosphere, which made it great for us because we love oxygen, but it actually made things horrible for all the other life forms on the planet. So really, you know, plants and the ancestors of plants have been polluting the planet long before humans did. So we learned from the masters in that way.
And it's fascinating that today's pollution was yesterday's life-giving substance, too. That was interesting.
Yeah.
To me. One of the things the second half of the book really does is it looks at who's thinking and working on, you know, ideas of survivability and mass extinction events. And, of course, we would think of the obvious choices, NASA on an asteroid strike, a pandemic, CDC, and the World Health Organization. But you found lots of people who are thinking about this.
Yeah, and I mean, it really depends on what kind of disaster you're worried about. Because, of course, the CDC, they're worried about pandemics, which are largely going to be isolated to just one or two species, particularly humans, obviously, is what they're worried about. But yeah, one of the things I focused on that ended up being really interesting to me was the number of people who work in city planning who are thinking about how to build cities that might be robust against future disasters. And you can think about these as anything from, you know, the kind of disasters we see a lot, earthquakes and storms and tsunamis, where cities are not often built to withstand those kinds of events. But then there's also people who are much more future-minded, architects and designers who are working with synthetic biologists to think about how we might build cities completely differently in the future to cope with this slow motion disaster of climate change. How do you build a city that is robust against climate change, not just because, you know, people can use that city even if it's underwater, but actually so that the city isn't producing carbon, so that it's not contributing to climate change anymore. And there's a lot of fantastic ideas about everything from how we could build cities out of living materials, genetically engineered living materials, such as algae or maybe even trees, so that the city itself, it sounds science fictional, but the city itself might become part of its environment. So it wouldn't be pumping carbon into the environment. It would actually be growing out of the environment. And you might have algae that was purifying your water, or algae that was being used as energy in your house. So you might just have a little cooker in your house making your own energy with this algae. And the other thing is, yeah.
I know. The thing about growing mold in your apartment to provide light at night.
Yeah, it sounds very futuristic, but actually there is mold today. There's algae today that emits a kind of nice blue-green glow. And so the idea is that perhaps with just a little bit of genetic tweaking, we could actually train this algae to respond to heat or movement so that when you walk into a room, the room might just start to glow on the ceiling from this algae in your environment. And so ultimately, you would end up with a city that would be a kind of living organism. And it wouldn't have to just be using fantastical materials like genetically engineered algae. It could also be something as simple as a city that has a smart grid that actually works really well. And the principle behind a smart grid is just that it functions kind of like the way your circulatory system does in your body. It sends energy to the parts of the city that need it most at the right time. And so you could imagine a city where all of the buildings are networked, and if there's a bunch of people in one building, that building says to the grid, hey, I need a lot more energy. But if in another building, no one's home, no one needs any energy, that building can say to the grid, I don't need any energy right now. Just don't feed me any energy. Because right now we have a problem where lots of energy gets sent kind of willy-nilly all over the grid, and it's not allocated in a way that it goes to the places that need it most. And so you end up wasting a lot of energy because it goes into devices that are kind of just sitting there turned on. So the idea would be that you'd have an electrical grid, like I said, that would act kind of like a human body or another kind of organism that really is smart about how it's putting its resources out into different parts of the city in order to save energy and in order to be more sustainable over time. So the city might become something like a giant living tree, or it might just become something where we use technology to make that city act more like an organism.
There's some really interesting people working on solutions and things like underground cities too, because, you know, radiation, you know, a couple of feet of earth is the best thing to stop that. And you sort of look at past cities that have existed underground. And are people actually thinking about this? We certainly thought about it during the Cold War when, you know, nuclear annihilation was, you know, 30 minutes away. But are people still thinking about that?
Absolutely. And there's a lot of reasons why engineers are thinking about how to build cities that are partially underground. Everything from building cities that are around underground transportation systems. We already see this in Montreal, where there's an enormous underground complex, miles and miles long, associated with their underground rail system. But there's also people who are thinking ahead to a radiation disaster, like you mentioned. It doesn't have to be just from nuclear bombs. It could also be from a nearby disaster in space. A star could explode or something else could happen and just send a ton of radiation coming our way. So the best solution is to get underground and to be thinking about how would you have an emergency underground shelter. You don't need much more than about 2 feet of rock between you and radiation to protect yourself. The question is, what are you going to have down under the ground? And I talked to a lot of really interesting engineers who mentioned problems with underground living that you might not have thought of. For example, there's the obvious stuff around getting air into the underground structures and building structures that are safe. And that's stuff that we understand pretty well. But what about people who just go nuts from living underground? Well, there's one really simple solution that a couple of designers came up with, which is that the reason why people tend to get crazy when they're in underground spaces is because everything underground looks the same, and it's very disorienting. So you're walking down hallways that all look the same, all the doorways look the same. So their suggestion is, if you're thinking of building an underground city, make it look like it has neighborhoods. Design different sections of that city to look different and to actually provide variety for the people living in them. And it's the kind of thing that you would never think about unless you were studying underground cities a lot and thinking about it. But it's a very simple solution that really can be psychologically calming for people to just feel like as they walk through their underground city, now I'm going into this neighborhood and things look different and the walls are painted differently and there's different rock being used for the buildings. So These are the kinds of things that when you're building an underground city, you have to think about, not just the structure, not just how safe it is, but also how livable is it?
My guest today is Anna Lee Newitz, author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. It's published by Doubleday. And the title, I assume that suggests what makes humans such good survivors, because this book is ultimately optimistic. You go through our history of our planet, and you see how Homo sapiens has been so adaptable, able to overrun the world very quickly from its beginnings, which is really interesting, this whole story about humans versus Neanderthals. That you describe the whole history as scientists know it today. And is that what makes humans such good survivors, the fact that when something like mass extinction events happens, we scatter, we adapt, and memory, that's very key.
Memory is a big thing. I mean, animals and other creatures that survived previous mass extinctions used the technique of scattering and adapting. That was the main way that animals survived these previous disasters, was by moving out of danger and finding new places to live where they could survive, even if it was very different from the places where they'd evolved. And humans, the thing that we have that most other animals don't seem to have is this ability to think about the future based on what we know of the past. And that can mean memory, like just remembering something that happened to you in your lifetime, some problem that you solved. But also, because humans keep detailed histories, and because we can use science to look back in evolutionary time and even geological time, we can call upon memories of ages that we never even lived in. We can look back 65 million years ago and say, well, what the heck happened to the dinosaurs? How is it that we can prevent something like that from happening to us? And so that's really, that memory part, that's the human part of our survival kit. And we can learn from other animals about how to adapt, and we have learned from other animals about how to adapt, but really humans are the ones that are going to have to figure out how to use those memories that we have and make really good plans for how to prevent disasters in the future, but also how to build our cities and how to live among each other in a way that prevents mass extinction from happening as well. We really have to be thinking of it both as a process of preventing disaster, but also building our cities, building into space in ways that will keep humans surviving for hopefully another million years, at least.
And of course, you just mentioned building into space, and one of the most interesting parts of the book is the idea about the space elevator, which I've heard before, but I've never been able to make sense of it, but it is a remarkable concept that people are really thinking about seriously, at least engineers at NASA, the space elevator.
That's right. So the space elevator was an idea that engineers at NASA came up with in the 1990s, although they based it on ideas even from science fiction in some cases. And what it is it's a way of getting people and machines into space without using rocket fuel, because rocket fuel is not a great long-term solution for getting people out of the gravity well of the planet. It's not sustainable, it's very polluting, it's very heavy, there's a lot of problems with it.
So it also tends to explode.
It also tends to explode, exactly. So it's a good short-term solution for getting people into space, but what if we really want to have a civilization where we're going into space all the time and going to the moon or Mars or wherever we end up living off the planet? So a space elevator is a way of solving that problem. And what it would be is a platform in the equator, which is attached by a super strong, thin ribbon of metal all the way 60,000 miles into space and attached to a counterweight, which would hold that tether taut. And that counterweight could be anything from a captured asteroid to something like the Death Star, like a big, giant, human-made object. But no matter what it's made of, what it is it's a port. And so you have enormous elevator cars that are really more like the size of a train car. And they would be going up that tether using robotic arms to lift themselves out of the gravity well. So you have to imagine a train car with huge industrial robotic arms at one end of it, climbing hand over hand up this super strong tether. Now, the question is, what would we make the tether out of? Some people think it would be made out of carbon nanotubes. but we still don't have a material that's strong enough to do that. So that's one of the big question marks around this technology. But the idea is just that the elevator cars could be used over and over and over again to get people out of the gravity well, up to a port, and then at that port, they would catch spaceships to other places, either to the moon or other planets, wherever they want to go. So it's a kind of interesting and possibly even technically feasible solution to really this basic question of what do you do after rocket fuel? How do you get into space without rocket fuel? And this would be a good way to just have people constantly going up and coming back down without using any fuel and without having to destroy whatever vessels you were using to get in and out of the gravity well, because that's the other problem, is you need something that's reusable. So it's possible that in a couple of hundred years, we might have one or two space elevators that were connecting people on Earth to outer space. And the way that you would get to the moon would be first you'd take an elevator ride, and then you would hop on a spaceship, and it would take you the rest of the way.
Yeah, it sounds kind of out there, but science has proven other things.
We're talking about the far future.
Yeah, right. Well, before I let you go, a couple of years ago, there was a science headline that says, are we in the beginning of a mass extinction? You spent a lot of time looking at our past, how we're adapting to the present and the future. What do you think? Is there current evidence that we may be at the beginning of a mass extinction today?
I think there is some evidence that we might be, and part of it comes from this fact that we already know from previous mass extinctions, which is that they're strongly correlated with climate change. And we know we're in a period of climate change, and so that is definitely a warning sign. The other warning sign comes from the fact that there are far more animals going extinct than we would typically expect. So there's a typical number of animals that should be going extinct all the time. You know, species naturally go extinct or evolve into something else. But right now, at least among land animals, the number of species going extinct on a year-by-year basis is about 30 times higher than what we would expect to see. So it's quite noticeably higher than the norm. The question is this just a statistical bump, or is it part of a larger trend? We just don't know yet. What we have is evidence that's based on about 200 years of observation. And, of course, we know that there have been dramatic extinctions among animals about 15,000 years ago when you saw things like woolly mammoths and mastodons dying out in the Americas, what are called megafauna, the yes. last of the really big animals. And so it's possible that this mass extinction really started about 15,000 years ago with those extinctions. So that would mean we'd be pretty well into the early stages. And the question is it going to keep going? Are we going to start seeing higher and higher numbers? And that's one of the reasons why it's very important for us to be thinking about how do we preserve and conserve as many life forms as possible. Because the real danger in mass extinction is that moment when enough creatures die out that they start causing these knock-on extinctions that we talked about earlier with coral reefs. So that's where humans can come in and intervene, is to try to prevent more extinctions from happening by conserving the animals that we have now and conserving the life forms that we have now and trying to maintain the environment the way that we like it, which is kind of cool and with, you know, lots and lots of diversity among animals and plants.
Annalee, thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Annalee Newitz is a science writer, the founding editor of the website io9.com, and the author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember, How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. It's published by Doubleday. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.